I'm going to talk about the work I'm doing on Foucault in the 1950s, particularly his work on psychology. Now, most people who have an interest in Foucault will know about the short book he published in 1962, Mental Illness and Psychology. But the book was a re-edition of an earlier book published in 1954, Mental Illness and Personality. It was a book that had been commissioned for an introductory philosophy series edited by Jean Lacroix for the Presse Universitaire de France. And it was Louis Althusser that made the connection between Foucault and Lacroix for this book. Now, in the early 1960s, Mental Illness and Personality had gone out of print. And because Foucault had just published The History of Madness in 1961, it seems that the press wanted to do a new edition. Now, Foucault actually tried to stop them from doing a new edition. He didn't want this book to be republished, but it seems that the contract that he had signed with them didn't allow him to stop publication. So presumably because he was working with them on The Birth of the Clinic, which comes out with the same publisher in 1963, Foucault agreed a compromise, which would be that he would revise the book from 1954 and it could be published again in 1962. Now, I don't have time to go into all of the differences between these books, the 54 version and the 62 version today. They range from some very minor things, some stylistic things, to more substantial things in the first few chapters. Chapter 5 of the 62 version is entirely new. It's entitled The Historical Constitution of Mental Illness, and it's effectively a hugely compressed summary of the History of Madness project. And then you have a kind of Frankenstein's monster, chapter 6, where Foucault tries to put some material that was in the 54 version with some new material and kind of glue it all together to make it work. It doesn't. But the idea is there to try and have this book that Foucault could at least live with in 1962. The original book's chapter 6 on Pavlov and reflex psychology is dropped entirely. There's no trace of that in the 62 version. And a new conclusion finishes this off. Now, Pierre Macherey and James Bernauer, among others, have done a comparison of these texts before, but neither of them did the systematic line-by-line, page-by-page version that I wanted to do for these tracing these differences between them. And I've made the whole of my analysis of this available up on my blog in the Foucault resources part of the blog for anyone else who might find it useful. I'd done the work and I thought somebody else might find something useful in there. I've done some other textual comparisons in the work I've done on Foucault from the different versions of The History of Sexuality, Volume 2 Introduction, to the variants of the What is an Author lecture, to the interview on the Raymond Roussel book. These exist in different editions and I've done basically that critical comparison work with those. What I'm doing at the moment is the two different versions of Foucault's inaugural lecture at the Collège de France, The Order of Discourse, that actually was published by the Collège de France before it was published by Gallimard, and the texts are quite different in some places, so I'm doing that kind of comparison again there. But to return back to this book, in 1962, Foucault tries to erase the traces of this book again. He doesn't want a new edition to come out after that 62 version of this. Didier Erebon describes the 62 version as a mongrel or a bastard of a kind of hybrid, some sort of mess of different material. And the press did republish it once more in Foucault's lifetime. 1966, there's a new edition. After that, Foucault seems to be successful in repressing any sense of this book having been published. But the press brought it back into print after Foucault's death, and it's been in print since in the Quadrige series from 1995 onwards. All of these later editions mention that there was a 1954 version, but they don't even tell you it had a different title, let alone that the material in it was quite different. And there's also a complicated story about the English edition of this text. There is a version of it that was published first in 1976 with Harper and Row, but the first 1954 edition has never been translated into English. But there was a story that it was attempted, and in the Congrium archive, I found correspondence between the University of California Press, who acquired the rights in the mid-1980s, and wanted to do an edition of the 1954 version. And it seems to be ironic, but the Presse Universitaire de France, despite having gone against Foucault's wish of a 1962 edition and a 1966 edition, in this correspondence tried to present themselves as the protectors of Foucault's legacy, and they prevent University of California Press doing an edition of the 1954 text. And instead they say the only thing that you can do is to print the 1962 translation that had already appeared in English in a new edition. Just to add to the confusion, the book is now actually back in print with Harper rather than California, and has now got a new title, Madness, the Invention of an Idea, which just does not describe what the book is about. As well as those publications, there are a couple of other publications from the 1950s, and I want to say a little bit about these. Foucault writes two book chapters, probably around 52, 53, although neither of them actually get published until 1957. And then they're reprinted in the D.A. Cree collection in 1994, having long gone out of print. The first of those to be written was a historical survey, a psychology from 1850 to 1950, that was commissioned by Dennis Heusman in 1952. And it seems that Foucault delivered the first draft, at least, in 1953. Heusman's project was to update a book that was already 100 years old, Alfred Weber's 19th Century History of European Philosophy. And the new edition doesn't appear in print until 1957, so a few years after Foucault finished writing this text, presumably because, like all edited books, you move at the speed of the slowest contributor, and lots of the other people in this book didn't produce their material so quickly. Foucault was asked to write a very particular piece. It's very much a commissioned piece, and it is mostly devoted to a survey of the 100 years since Weber's book had been published, where Foucault schematizes the reading of the literature in psychology. He's reading in French, German, and in English, and it clearly draws on a wide knowledge of this subject matter, but it's not especially an original work. It's a work that was commissioned for this updated textbook, effectively. Foucault writes another survey around this same time, which is for another collection. The piece that Foucault writes is on scientific research and psychology, and it's for a book that is a collection of pieces by French researchers who are talking about the state of the art in the field that they work in. So while the piece that Foucault wrote for the Heusman and Weber collection is historical and retrospective, the piece for this French contemporary researchers book is much more of an assessment of the way things are at the time. And it seems that Foucault was commissioned to write this not just because he was teaching psychology, which I'll say more about in a moment, but also because he was doing practical work in psychology. So it's as much a work about being a practitioner of psychological research at this moment as it is about writing an academic study of that work. Now, although D.A. Cree, the collection of Foucault's short writings, is an incredibly valuable collection, I've made it a focus of a lot of the work that I've been doing on Foucault to go back to the original places in which texts were published, if at all possible, to find the original place. Partly because you can see who Foucault was in company with, if it was a collection, there's sometimes editorial material that's helpful. And this was one of the times when it was useful to go back to the original source, because the historical survey in the Dennis Heusman edited collection, the historical survey actually has a 2-page annotated bibliography in the original publication that doesn't appear in D.A. Cree, and that seems to me to be an interesting piece in its own sense. Neither of these two pieces have been translated into English, and both, I think, are of minor interest in general terms, but they seem to me to be important in terms of Foucault's intellectual development. The other early publication that you can see there, and is probably the most famous of the publications that Foucault did in the 1950s, is the long introduction that he wrote to a translation of Ludwig Binswanger's Dream and Existence essay. Now, in that book, the translation was credited to Jacqueline Verdot, but Foucault clearly had a very active role in the shaping and the translating of that text, especially in terms of the philosophical vocabulary. Binswanger was using a lot of Heideggerian terms in his work at this time, and very little of Heidegger had been translated into French at this moment in the mid-1950s. So Foucault and Verdot are having to shape the vocabulary of how to translate Heidegger as he is being used by Binswanger, rather than having a whole set of Heidegger texts in French at the time where they could simply make these terms commensurate with the accepted practice. Foucault also adds two long notes to the translation, which have never been reprinted in full. They're not in the either in the English translation of this essay or even in the later French republication of this translation that Foucault and Verdot worked on. Some of them are incorporated into a glossary in the later reprint of it. But they're revealing, I think, in terms of how Foucault understands two key terms in both Binswanger and in Heidegger, the notions of Dasein and Stimmung. So here's the first of those two notes. With the author's agreement, says Foucault, we have translated Dasein as presence. Of course, this translation does not mean to put it within the spatio-temporal coordinates of the hic and nunc of objectivity, but it seems more useful to us than the usual existence in order to give the significative structure of the German word Dasein, which they gloss as être là. Presence expresses both existence in a situation, presence here, and at the same time its opening to a world, presence to the world. So this is 1954, this is published. So Dasein, of course, as people who know Heidegger will recognise, is an important term in Heidegger, and the translation of this term is a widely contested one. And the reason that Dasein is not a straightforward term to translate in Heidegger, or one of the reasons it's not straightforward, is that Heidegger also uses the notion of existenz, of Latinate rather than just German roots, and translations have to find some kind of way of marking the difference between these two terms. So Heidegger says, for example, the essence of Dasein lies in its existenz. So you have to find a way to translate these terms differently in order to understand what Heidegger's saying there. Now, Heidegger goes out of his way to stress that the da part of Dasein, there, literally, should not be understood in a straightforward spatial sense of location. But many early French translations or adaptions, like Sartre's Being and Nothingness, do use that notion of être là, literally being there, as it sometimes appears in English translations. But the earliest French translations of Heidegger, particularly Henri Corbin's translation of What is Metaphysics in 1938, actually used the term réalité humaine, human reality, as the way to translate the notion of Dasein. Derrida somewhere says that this is a hideous translation. But keeping that German word Dasein has become standard practice, to keep the German word in an English or a French translation and to give that emphasis on the term as Heidegger uses it. But because Binswanger adopts that Heideggerian distinction between Dasein and existenz, Foucault and Verdot have to face that challenge. The second note that Foucault writes for the translation, I think, is also revealing. Binswanger employs the word Stimmung to designate as much the affective coloration of a lived experience as the receptive characteristic of human existence, considered at the level of an ontological existential. However, no single French word seems to correspond to this broad meaning, so we have translated Stimmung as humour, humeur, each time the word Stimmung is analysed at the level of psychological experience. Now, we might quibble with the choice of humeur to translate Stimmung, but they clearly understand what is being got at here in both Heidegger and in Binswanger, to think about that, whether we would translate today as something like mood or attunement or even possibly the notion of affect. But there's clearly a sense of understanding the significant weight of this term in that work. Elisabeth de Basso, who's really the authority on Foucault's engagement with Dasein analysis and on Foucault's work in this period around psychology, she's indicated that the work on this translation that Foucault and Verdot were doing began at the end of 1953 and was completed in February 1954, when a copy of the translation, the draft translation, was sent to Binswanger. Now, the standard story in the biographies, particularly in the Didier Erebon and David Macy, is that having completed the translation, Jacqueline Verdot says to Foucault, well, if you like it so much, write a preface to it. And Foucault does just that. Around Easter 1954, he completes a text that is about twice as long as the text it purports to introduce. And it had seemed that Foucault did the research on Binswanger in order to write that preface, just to write that introduction or that preface, reading deeply into Binswanger's work in order to do that. But the story is only partly true. As is so much of what we know about Foucault in the 1950s, the opening up of the archive sheds a lot more light on this story, because we now have access to Foucault's correspondence with Binswanger, along with some notes from Jacqueline Verdot and her husband, Georges Verdot, to Binswanger. And Elisabeth de Basso's archival work has established that the visits that Foucault and Verdot made to visit Binswanger in Switzerland took place in March and September 1954, where they also met with Roland Kuhn, another psychologist whose book on Rorschach tests and the phenomenology of masks Verdot also translated. And the book that was published a couple of years ago, Foucault and Münsterlingen, includes some of that correspondence, and it also includes a lot of documentary materials around these visits that Foucault and Verdot took to Binswanger in Switzerland, but also where they attended this festival of fools. These masks here were people in the local asylum. Now, Foucault talks about this somewhat elliptically in a couple of interviews, but the story is told in the biographies, but this book provides a lot more documentary evidence of what actually happened on those visits and the correspondence. We can fill in a lot more detail of this story. But the other thing that we now crucially know that was not clear before is that Foucault gives a whole course on Binswanger a little earlier than the writing of this introduction to Binswanger translation. And Foucault gives this course on phenomenology and Binswanger at the University of Lille, where he was teaching psychology to philosophy students in the early 1950s. Now, there's some question marks about dating of this course. Foucault's not very good at dating things. It's almost everything in the archive is undated in terms of his reading notes and so on. But we can look at it in terms of what was appearing in the course catalogues and also what is appearing in terms of the paper that Foucault is using to write some of his lecture notes, which help to give us a date after which this lecture must have been written, because it's things like a flyer for a meeting that took place in November 1952 and so on. So the course probably took place in either 1952-53 or the following year, or possibly both, that Foucault would have repeated the same course across two different years. Daniel Defaire also reports that in March 1953, Foucault translated some other works by Binswanger, including his work on Delirium, even though he didn't publish these translations. And as far as I can tell, these translations are not in the archive of material. But it seems clear that whether the course came from 52-53 or 53-54, Foucault would have delivered this whole course on Binswanger, which is extremely detailed, before he finished doing the work on the translation, and certainly before he wrote the introduction to it. So rather than being persuaded by Verdot to write an introduction to a book that he just helped to translate, Foucault actually had a wealth of material on Binswanger before this, which he now finds a way to actually use as an outlet by writing the introduction to this text. Now, Foucault's course on Binswanger is one of three main courses that are preserved from the early 1950s that all relate to his teaching in Lille, but he was also teaching at the École Normale Supérieure in Paris at the same time. There's another course on phenomenology and psychology, which is probably from 1953 to 54, but it's a course that becomes a course on Husserl. Quite what his students made of this, I think, is anyone's guess, because he's supposed to be teaching psychology. He was hired by a philosophy department who did not want to teach psychology themselves, and they wanted him to teach the psychology to their students who were asking for it. Foucault finds a way to turn this into a course on Husserl at this time. And there's another course on knowledge of man and transcendental reflection, which we also know was certainly given in Paris in 1954-55, although it probably had the title Problems of Anthropology at that time. Now, Foucault doesn't do very much with either the Binswanger material or the Husserl courses, despite the care with which he prepared them. If you look at Foucault's later lecture courses, the Collège de France courses, and the published versions of them, they look like they're written out in huge detail, perfectly formed sentences and so on. But this is because they are transcriptions of recordings. The vast majority of Foucault's Collège de France courses are not written out in full detail. They're in note form, which Foucault would elaborate on as he was speaking. And the transcription of that recording, then consult the manuscript and fill in the notes as the work of the editor for those courses. But in distinction, when Foucault was first teaching at the beginning of his career in the early 1950s, Foucault did write out his courses in complete sentences, and he footnoted them carefully. They read like book manuscripts, these three courses that have been preserved. And it seems that Foucault could have taken a career choice to become somebody who worked on Dasein analysis, this idea of bringing Heidegger to approach in psychology, which is what Binswanger and others are doing, or he could have gone down the route of doing the Husserl scholarship that he was clearly able to do based on the documents in these courses. But Foucault doesn't do anything with those materials really at all. The 1954 publication of the Binswanger book seems to be the last time that he really worked on the notion of Dasein analysis at all. Now, Foucault's course, though, on knowledge of man and transcendental reflection does have an important legacy in terms of Foucault's writing. Because in this course, Foucault is interested in the idea of philosophical anthropology, which he understands as the science of the human rather than ethnography. And in this course, he talks about figures from Kant to Hegel to Dilthey. And in a later version of the course, the 54-55 version that he gave in Paris, he adds in a discussion of Nietzsche and some discussion of Heidegger's reading of Nietzsche, at least as that was possible at the time when not much of Heidegger's reading of Nietzsche had been published. And this, of course, feeds into Foucault's secondary thesis, which was the translation of Kant's Anthropology along with a long introduction. But the encounter with Nietzsche, which of course has an important afterlife for Foucault, seems to have first been turned into some kind of use in terms of the teaching in the final parts of that course in 1955. There's also some short manuscripts on Nietzsche from the mid-1950s that develop that interest, probably from the period when Foucault moved to Uppsala. So these courses and materials, which are all due to be published over the next several years, I think are extremely interesting. There's a lot of other fragments of material from this time, a lot of problems about dating, a lot of problems about what actually some of these materials actually are. But there are some notes by some of Foucault's students from this time in some other archives. And while I wouldn't use student notes alone as the basis for what Foucault said, if you put them together or kind of cross-reference them with the material that's in the Foucault archive, they do at least help with things like dating about when Foucault might have given a particular lecture on a topic. But importantly, it's worth saying that there are real gaps in our knowledge in the archive. Foucault's teaching at the University of Uppsala when he was teaching French literature, there seems to be very little material from that period that has been preserved in the archive. We still don't know very much about what he did in Warsaw and in Hamburg beyond what's in the biographies, although there's a few more traces of that. And we don't know very much about what Foucault was doing as that active practitioner in psychological research, the work he did at the Saint-Anne Hospital in Paris and the Fresnes prison in the early 1950s. Foucault makes a few brief comments in interviews and the biographies. Erebon and Macy particularly say some things about it, but there's not many other sources, at least that I've found, that fill in detail about that period. Now, Foucault, of course, continues to engage with psychology after the mid-1950s. The History of Madness, of course, the recently published courses on sexuality from the 1960s, the History of Sexuality itself, particularly the first volume, the 1970s lecture courses and seminars on psychiatric power in criminal justice, all moments when Foucault is still engaging with this material. And we have a lot of new material about those posthumous publications in the archive that helps to fill in detail about those later engagements with psychology. But it seems to me that this period in the early 1950s, the archival material is filling in parts of that story that weren't so clear before. Something else that isn't really discussed in the 1950s, the other publication that Foucault's involved in, is his co-translation of Victor von Weizsäcker's Der Gestaltkreis, a book on kind of medical anthropology, where Weizsäcker is taking the notion of Gestalt theory, but thinking about it in terms of physiological movement rather than just in terms of psychology. So the book that I'm writing at the moment on the early Foucault tries to make sense of all of this material and lots of other sources to fill in some of these details about this story. Effectively, it's a story of how Foucault came to write The History of Madness, but to try and treat all of the things that came before The History of Madness as worthy of investigation in their own right. And so I'm interested in the way that Foucault was engaging with psychology, with philosophical figures as a way of thinking about questions in psychology, and to raise a whole set of philosophical and historical questions in his engagement with this material. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Stuart. So,